if something happens, you get laid off, the gig ends early, the company gets sold, whatever it is, you're okay because there's an ongoing stream of inbound opportunities coming towards you. That's what it means to be forever employable. And that's what I talk about in the book, is how to create that presence, that personal brand, that thought leadership that ensures that you're top of mind for the people who need the services that you provide.
I think it's terribly important to insist on individual values.
Learning Culture Podcast.
Initiative, creation, all these things which we value. It's now possible to make organizations on a larger scale than was ever possible before.
Learning Culture Podcast.
Teach people to analyze the kind of things that are said to them.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Learning Culture Podcast. I am your host, Andrew Barry. This is a show about creating cultures of continuous learning inside companies.
I'm your host, Andrew Barry, and joining me this week was Jeff Gotthelf. Jeff helps organizations build better products. He's the co-author of the award-winning book, Lean UX, and the creator of the methodology that goes into Lean UX, which has gone on to inform hundreds of companies' approaches to software design and product design in general. He started off as a software designer and now works as a coach, consultant, and keynote speaker, helping companies bridge the gap between business agility, digital transformation, product management, and human-centered design. He's written numerous books since Lean UX, selling upwards of 1 million copies across his collection of books. And in this conversation, we spend most of our time focused on his book, Forever Employable. The book chronicles Jeff's transition from employee to agency owner to independent operator. It teaches you how to stop looking for work and let your next job find you. Jeff has codified a framework for thought leadership. In our conversation, he shares how to plant your flag, how to pick that topic that you can become an expert in. He shares a number of key takeaways, which outline the framework that he shares in the book. You'll learn how to find the right place to plant your flag as a thought leader. You'll learn how to master storytelling from the position of your newly planted flag. You'll learn how to create opportunities by creating content. Jeff has a refreshingly simple way of thinking about what many of us want to be able to do, which is to secure our own financial freedom by becoming a thought leader and respected expert on the thing that we're good at. To learn more about Jeff's work, check out his website, which we've included in the show notes, to find courses, books, and other media to help you along your journey. That journey starts now. So please sit back and enjoy my conversation with Jeff Gotthelf. Jeff, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andrew. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's go back to kind of the beginning. You put yourself on the map by authoring a book called Lean UX with a collaborator, created kind of a concept, a movement of Lean UX. How did that originate? How did you come up with that idea? What problem were you solving then?
So this is the most amazing part. I've talked about this for so long, is that Lean UX came from doing the work. So I was, the year is roughly 2008. I'm the director of user experience at a company called The Ladders in New York City. And I'm trying to build a design team in an organization, a high growth startup that's doing really, really well. And they're transitioning from a waterfall method of software development to an agile method of software development. And I have to build a design team, number one. And number two, I have to build a design team in that new way of working, which in 2008 was very, very, very fresh still, even though it had been around for about a decade, still not the level of adoption that we see today. And so I've got to build a design team. And I've got to build a design team in this new way of software development. And we can't figure it out. But we're struggling to figure it out because we knew how to do software design in that linear world where we had a design phase that could go anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months. And we had all that time to do design work, but now we've got 2 weeks to do everything. And so that was the problem we set out to solve. And I was fortunate enough to work in an organization where my boss said, look, figure it out, do what you need to do, but you've got to be successful. And so tell me what you need and I'll help you, but figure it out. And so working with my team, working with some colleagues from outside, some folks that I'd known in the industry, we managed to put together over after trial and error over the course of 9 months, a way of working that worked for us. And that was Lean UX. And as we were working towards that goal of solving that problem, I was sharing our work. I was blogging about it. As it was happening, yeah, in real time.
Yeah.
And I wasn't just sharing the wins. I shared a lot of the crappy stuff that we tried and did not work, and what we learned from it, and what we're going to try the next time. And it turns out, look, I went to other companies. I said, how are you folks doing this? And there were a few answers here, and there were a few pieces here and there to kind of pick and choose and start to synthesize together. But ultimately, no one had a good answer. And when we got to an answer, I wrote about it. And that became became Lean UX. And it turns out that pretty much, I hate to speak in absolutes. So I'll say like 99% of software development teams struggle with this problem to this day. And that's why the thing went huge.
Yeah. So what were some of the characteristics or features that you guys figured out in that time that is now part of the Lean UX idea that differentiated it?
The most important thing we figured out is that when you invest heavily for an extended period of time in an idea, you're taking a tremendous amount of risk. And the chances of you being right straight out of the gate are very, very, very low. And so the odds are that you are going to waste a tremendous amount of your time, effort, money, IP, whatever it is, marketing budget in that situation. And so instead of treating our ideas as done deals, I had an idea, so it's got to be good, we treat all of our ideas as assumptions. That was a fundamental thing, because what you're doing is you're introducing doubt.
Yeah.
You know, you're introducing skepticism, enthusiastic skepticism, let's be clear, right, into your ideas. And now if there's doubt in the idea, we frame the assumptions as hypotheses, right? So instead of saying, we know that building this product or this service or this content or this course or whatever it is going to be a surefire hit, we're saying, we believe that it's going to help people in this way, and we'll know that we're right when we see a change in their behavior. So fundamentally, the two biggest changes that we made in Lean UX was framing the work as with doubt and risk as assumptions and hypotheses, and then changing the measure of success for the work from delivering the work to positively impacting the behavior of the consumers of the work. Right. And that is such a big change for companies, because it's really, really easy to measure delivery, right? Like, did you make the thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
There's the thing. Yeah. I made it.
Right.
And so it's binary, right? You did or you didn't. And if it's easy to measure, it's easy to manage, it's easy to reward. Yeah. But hey, did you increase the conversion rate by 50%? Did you increase retention? Did you get people to buy a second class from us? You know, 80% of people to get buy a second class from us. Well, I got 57% of people to do it, right? It's a lot more fuzzy in that situation.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the latter measure of success, right, the outcome, the change in customer behavior, actually tells you whether you delivered something of value.
Yeah.
Right. So you might think the idea is great and you might execute it perfectly, but if nobody buys it, nobody uses it, nobody tells their friends, nobody buys it a second time, it wasn't good, no matter how much you loved it.
It takes that element of hope out that you talked about earlier. The other thing you talked about earlier was permission. And it seems like that this process gives you permission to be wrong, to fail. Right. And that's incredibly important to the process.
It makes it easier to be wrong, right? Let's be clear. Look, and I used to use this phrase all the time, like fail fast, fail often, right? Nobody wants to fail, right? We don't. We do not want to fail. Nobody does. But learning, who doesn't want to learn, right? Learn fast, learn often. And we learn by being wrong, right? We learn by making mistakes, right? You don't learn to ski by getting to the top of the mountain and just going, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got it, right? You learn by falling 100 times and then falling 75 times and then 50, right? Like that type of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so these shorter cycles of testing the idea, of seeing whether it impacts customer behavior, reduce our level of investment in the idea. And if we invest less in the idea, it's easier to be wrong. It hurts less, right? If you spend 2 weeks on an idea and it gets no traction, right? Your experiment gets no traction. It's a lot easier to let that idea go than if you spent 2 months or 2 years on that idea. And so our goal is to invest as little as possible in our ideas. And then if we see traction for the minimally viable versions of those ideas, then we invest a little bit more and a little bit more. And we continue to de-risk with greater investments. Now, the risks get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as we get more positive feedback from the market, right? But like we said before, we have enough evidence from the market that gives us permission to spend a bit more to run a bigger test.
Yeah, yeah. So last question, I think, on the idea, and then I want to fast forward in time in your career. But is there a limit to the number of experiments you should be running at any given time? Did you find anything in your experience that helped with that?
So look, there's no concrete number, right? I can't say that, you know, 17, right? That's it. 18 is you've gone overboard, right? It's not that. But I do believe that there is a limit. I think the limit is contextual to you and your team. So if you're working by yourself, you're not going to run 100 experiments. You might run two or three, right? If you're working with a team and the experiments are different enough, you might run a couple, right? If you work in a large organization, you can still run multiples, right? But there's a risk here because at some point the variables get confused and you don't really know what actually had the impact that you were looking for. And so generally speaking, keep it simple. Experiment, run the fewest number of experiments that you need to, finish them, learn from them, and use that learning to inform the next set of experiments. But you'll get a sense really quick when you're getting too much data and you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. I feel like that's something that a lot of creators also, I mean, I guess I'm just speaking for myself. Like, you want to test so many different things, but there is definitely a limit to be aware of that you should really prioritize, focused, and like you said, get through the cycle as quickly as you can. To move on to the next thing. So your books did exceptionally well. They're award-winning. They've sold hundreds of thousands of copies. You've since released other books on these ideas, and now you work with companies in consulting capacity. When did you make that leap from working on that team to, all right, I'm going to create a brand for myself around this and become... You know, I put my flag in the ground of thought leadership.
Yeah. January 2012 is when I quit my last full-time job.
4 years after you were sort of working with that team on this and developing the idea. Okay.
Yep. And that was the end of the engagement with that team. So that was it. That was the last full-time in-house job that I held was in January 2012. And I set out to build an agency, a product development, digital product development studio with, two partners, one partner who I'd met doing similar kind of work as I was. It's Josh Seiden. We ended up writing Lean UX together, Sense and Respond together. We built businesses together. And the other is Giff Constable, who's been a good friend and a colleague for many years as well. And we decided to build a digital product studio based on these principles of Lean UX. Now, Giff and Josh were going to go sell work. And I was going to build the brand with thought leadership, with content based around Lean UX, because I was heavily, heavily associated with that brand. That was the underpinning for our ways of working. And nobody had heard of our company. And so it was my job to go out there and give the talks and do the presentations and get in front of people and talk about our company so that when people wanted and were ready to work this way, we were top of mind for them. And it worked. It really did work. I mean, I don't think we ever paid for advertising. I don't think we ever did any real marketing. It was thought leadership. And look, and the content that thought leadership generated also generated revenue. So it actually became a meaningful part of our studio. Was not just product development, but we actually did trainings and workshops and coaching and that type of thing.
And your two partners there, their job was business development, just to go out there, close deals, follow up on leads, close deals, that kind of thing.
I mean, yeah, look, it was sales. It was delivery because, you know, we were a 5-person company at that point and running the business. So there was operations as well. I mean, it was a startup. It was a services startup, but it was a startup. And then as it grew, you know, the partner level individuals were also the biz dev people as well.
Yeah. 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 What was the most challenging thing about leaving full-time employment and building out this agency?
Money. really? I mean, no, really. Usual. I mean, yeah, but that's the truth. I mean, look, I've been the sole financial provider for our family of four for 18 years, right? Since my first daughter was born. And in 10 years ago, my kids were 8 and 4. And I was making a decent salary, New York City tech salary in 2012, but I was barely saving anything. Really, I mean, realistically, we were living basically paycheck to paycheck. I was skimming off the top to fund a 401k, a retirement account. But more than that, and so I'd managed to save, I think, like a 3-month runway. And these guys were like, let's start a company. And I was like, if this doesn't work, you know, I've got three months, right? Like basically before this really starts to, I have to start digging into retirement savings and figuring out what to do next. And so that was the toughest part. The toughest part was making the financial leap. Because I wasn't prepared. Like these guys said, hey, in 2 years, we're going to start a company, start saving. Right. This all happened very, very quickly.
Right.
And I was terrified. I wasn't going to be able to provide for my family. I wasn't going to feed my kids. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. That's the hardest part. I mean, I think even if you do prepare for that for a year or two, there's still a mental shift from going like knowing that no matter what happens this month, you're going to get a paycheck at the end of it to, well, I actually have to earn that paycheck. And there may be months where we don't get any paycheck and then we get one big one at the end of the year. Like sort of that uncertainty and risk that goes into a lot more to stomach, obviously, than a salary.
Look, it's an addiction, right? You're addicted to that paycheck every 2 weeks, right? Every 2 weeks that you got to get that hit. And if you don't get it, things start to go sideways and it really is like an addiction. And that's been one of the most liberating things about my becoming a consultant after the agency we ended up selling it and moving on has been the moving off of that biweekly drip, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? That's a cool way of looking at it as an addiction that you actually have to kick the habit. Yeah,
you do. It's terrifying because look, I mean, in 2012, so I started working a little bit late because I tried to be a rock star for a few years. But so I started working professionally when I was 26, right? Yeah. And so rather than all my friends who started when they were 22, so roughly speaking, it took a few years to live my dream. And so I was 39 in 2012. I was making about 200 grand a year. Mm-hmm. Roughly speaking. And there is, you know, there's just this over the years, as you make more money, your lifestyle expands to spend that money.
Yeah.
Right. Like when we started having kids, you know, 8 years earlier, I wasn't making 200 grand a year. I was probably making 100 grand a year and we lived fine. Right. But all of a sudden it expands. And so you get addicted to it and it's the career expectation, right? I started off making $38,000 as a web designer back in 1999 or 32 grand or whatever it was, right? Now I'm at 200 and, you know, sort of the law of the corporate ladder dictates that the next move gets me to 220 and the next move after that gets me to 250, right? And breaking out of that expectation, right? The thing that I saw my father do, the thing I saw my mother do, the thing that I saw, you know, their friends do and my friends do. It's difficult. It's terrifying. And most folks won't do it.
Yeah. So you did it. Not only did you do it, you've now written a book about it, in a sense. And let's dive into that now. It's called Forever Employable. What does it mean to be forever employable?
Yeah. So I think the subtitle of the book does more heavy lifting than the title. I think the title was catchy, which I enjoyed. But the subtitle of the book really describes it. It's basically how to stop looking for work and let jobs find you. And that's really the fundamental idea here. So if you think about this think about it as a system, right? Traditionally, careers and job hunting are what they call a push system. A push system is when you inject yourself into situations. You push yourself into a job opening, into an interview, into an opportunity, and you give up control, right? So you kind of put yourself out there and then you're sort of floating in the system and you're waiting for other actors to decide whether or not you're good enough, smart enough, have enough experience or cultural fit, right? And then they choose you for the next position, the next promotion, the next pay raise. That is the way it's always been done. And that is increasingly riskier every single day, right? There's just too much change. There's too much volatility. And I don't think you can rely on that anymore. And so if you're looking to build some kind of stability and consistency in your life, you have to take that model and reverse it 180 degrees and create what's called a pull model, where you're pulling on the system continuously. And what I mean by that is that you're always doing things that are attracting opportunities towards you from the system. And what that does, it is it puts you in charge. You decide which opportunity to pursue because, well, I'm going to take that speaking gig. I'm going to take that consulting gig. I'm going to take that full-time job or that raise or that promotion because they are constantly coming to you. And so if something happens, you get laid off, the gig ends early, the company gets sold, whatever it is, you're okay because there's an ongoing stream of inbound opportunities coming towards you. That's what it means to be forever employable. And that's what I talk about in the book, is how to create that presence, that personal brand, that thought leadership that ensures that you're top of mind for the people who need the services that you provide.
Yeah. So lots to unpack here. A lot of the lessons that you've learned from the corporate world, from product development specifically, like testing, minimizing risk, things that we've talked about now, I think reflect in this work. And so let's start at the beginning. Like what does this roadmap look like? What should someone be thinking about right at the start?
So most importantly, you need to decide where to plant your flag. That's the first step in the book, Plant Your Flag. And Plant Your Flag is really just determining what are you going to build your platform on top of? What is the idea, the foundational thing that you're going to be known for? And, you know, it's easy to think about this from a professional side of things, but what do you do? What are you good at? Kind of what is this, you know, what's your career been? But on a personal or a hobby side, you could go that way too. For example, I told you I tried to be a rock star. I played piano, played piano my whole life. You know, when I was thinking about where to plant my flag, when I lived in New Jersey, I had a fairly large collection of vintage electric pianos. And I know I know a lot. I have an extensive amount of useless knowledge about vintage electric pianos, simply because it's a thing that I enjoy and I care about. I love the way they sound, and I love the mechanics of it and the whole thing. And look, one of the places I thought about planting my flag was, you know, maybe I'll become the vintage electric piano guy. Right? And look, there's an audience for that. There is, but it's not that big, and you know, the opportunity to monetize that audience and that content is significantly lower than monetizing things like digital product development, digital product design, lean UX, ultimately. And so planting your flag is the first step. Now, what's interesting is after I published the book, I discovered that there's, sadly, it's not in the book, but it is on my blog. There's this Japanese framework called Ikigai that I discovered after I wrote the book. Now, there's a westernized bastardization of it. That I really like. Like so the original Ikigai is much more spiritual and emotional. But I don't know who exactly, but somebody basically took it and westernized it and bastardized it a bit.
Yeah.
but I really like this other version of it because I think it really helps you identify where to plant your flag. So the bastardized version of Ikigai, it's called the westernized version.
The supposed way, yeah.
The westernized version of it asks four questions. Okay, first question is, what do you love? Right, what do you love? Like, well, I love vintage electric pianos. I love designing products. Right, what are you good at? Right? Because love and good at aren't necessarily the thing. I love basketball. Yeah. I'm not good at it. Right,
right.
So, what do you love? What are you good at? What does the world need right now? Which is a really nice question to really think about. And then the fourth question is, what can you get paid for? And the idea is to start answering those questions individually and then eventually get to a point where you have found answers that actually answer all four questions. And it's if you could figure out one or two things that you love, that you're good at, that the world needs, and that you can get paid for, that's a good place to start planting your flag or to start running some experiments around whether or not you should be planting your flag there.
Yeah, I love that. So first of all, I said thank you because so many people assume that Ikigai is what you just described now. So I'm so glad you prefaced that by saying it's the Western version of it. It draws from something, like you said, much more spiritual and just really good inspiration there. But I also love the framework and it applies so well here. The other interesting aspect of this that I've talked to people about is that I find a lot of people struggle. They want to they think of it as you have to discover. They think of it as like you have to architect this thing where it actually, I find it easier to think of it as archaeology. Like it's already there. It already exists within you. You have to find it. And those four questions help you kind of navigate that.
I agree. Yeah. And I think that's right. And I've run this Ikigai exercise with teams and with in workshops and things like that. And, you know, and people always start with what are you good at? Project management. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Come on. Let's dig a little deeper. Right. Like, and so it's worth it to do it with a coach or to get some feedback. So you really get into the sort of the core values, but it's exactly what you're doing. You're peeling away these layers to get to the thing that you actually love to do and are good at, hopefully somebody can pay you for it.
Yeah. And then you mentioned this earlier as well. It's a problem. I don't think you use these words, but it's a problem worth solving. So you've connected it to something where it is a problem and people will pay to have that problem solved. Like the electric piano thing, not many people will pay you a lot of money to help them with the electric pianos, but with product development, obviously that's a whole nother story. So that's a good starting point. So you find you've got your flag in the ground. Now you mentioned, I think, content and thought leadership basically comes into this now. But what is that next step in your framework?
So the next step is to tell your story and it's to become a storyteller. And this is the thing that I think terrifies people the most. It's one thing to say, look, I'm going to talk about project management. I'm going to talk about NFTs or whatever it is, right? But the next step is to actually become a compelling storyteller about this topic. And this comes from practice and feedback and iteration and experimentation across a variety of channels. And so you're experimenting on how to deliver your ideas, who to deliver it to, and what is the best format, not only for them to consume it, but for you to deliver it, right? So for example, I know people who are very, very good on camera, but they hate writing. They hate it. They won't sit down and write, but they'll put on a camera and they'll record a 15-minute video, no problem. And vice versa. People are terrified of turning on the camera. I would much rather write 7,000 words to get their ideas out there. And so the idea here is to start telling your story. And we talked about this earlier, right? So we take small bites of risk to help us determine where our audience lives and how to best reach them, right? So should I tweet to these folks? Should I make 3-minute YouTube videos? Should I make TikToks? Should I, whatever it is, right? Should I write blog posts for them? Do they want to read 10,000 word essays, right?
Right.
Maybe they do. But the idea is that you're learning how to tell the story. I'll share with you an example of this. Right before the pandemic, I flew to California to teach a one-day Lean UX workshop with a gaming company out in California. super cool offices, like 40 years of video game history in there. It was amazing. And I teach, it was really, really cool. And so I spent a day there and I teach the class. And at the end of the class, the woman who hired me comes up to me and she goes, "Jeff, that was really great." She goes, "Everything that you taught the folks, I already knew. But what you gave me was a vocabulary to use, a language to use to describe this way of working that I didn't have before." And to me, that was such a massive compliment because I'd spent a decade refining that story. Really. Like, look, yeah. I still teach Lean UX today. The third edition of the book is coming out in the next month, right? But I've spent a decade refining that conversation, telling that story to the point now where I can really tell it in a compelling and succinct way. And in some situations, that's what I'm teaching people is how to tell that story because they know the tactics already because it's been around for so long. And so storytelling is so, so, so critical. And you've got to find your niche. You've got to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. I like this idea of, I mean, it is in the nature of storytelling is creating this common language that people can then see the world becomes a lens through which they can see the world. They can see the problem that you've zeroed in on and they can solve it now because you've given them that lens through which to look at it.
And you connect the dots for them, right? So they might believe in the idea. They might believe in the tactic, but connecting it to a change that they need to make or the way that they're doing things today and how that might be different in the future, that's what you're helping them do with the story.
Amazing. Jeff, this has just been such an enjoyable conversation. I feel like we're thinking and working on similar things, and it's been incredible to hear your experience predating mine by a lot more, a lot longer. Yeah, just kind of seeing how you've put this all together. I think it's very instructive for people. So I just want to, thank you for all the work you put out and for spending this time with me today.
My pleasure. This was a ton of fun. I could talk about this forever.
Awesome. The thing, opportunity to quickly share, like, what are you most excited about? What would you encourage people to check out on what you're working on right now?
Yeah, so self-paced courses, the most exciting thing I'm working on right now. I've got one out on OKRs, objectives and key results, which every company is dealing with right now. There's a Lean UX one that's out, and I'm working on the Forever Employable self-paced course as we speak. So jeffgotthelf.com, there's a link that says self-paced courses. Check it out. You can go from there.
We'll include all those links and resources that you have on that website as well in the show notes. Jeff, thanks so much. Take care.
Hello, hello. I hope you enjoyed that episode. It's Andrew again with a quick message. If you'd like to support the show, the best way to do that is to leave us ratings and reviews where you listened. If you're on YouTube, hit the like and subscribe buttons and feel free to leave a comment. We love hearing from our listeners and viewers. If you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please take the time to give us a rating and leave a review. Once again, we love hearing from our loyal listeners. If you're listening to this on Spotify, please hit the follow button to make sure that you don't miss new episodes as they come out. Thank you for listening.